putting it all together. What we need to ask ourselves, finally, is what the ramifications are of all this postmodernist thinking in the realm of philosophy. While Pomo hasn't necessarily overturned classical thinking, it has taken over much of academia. What does this mean for us as beginning philosophers? With any luck, we can now start putting it all together in such a way that it makes sense as we explore the final ideas that define the postmodern. To do this, we go back to the concept we started with, narrative. The narrative, the expression of who we are and what we are, has been our subject from the beginning. We talked about how we invented stories to account for things we couldn't otherwise explain. We talked about how our skills kept improving and our narratives got stronger and clearer, until finally we went past narratives and started studying narration itself. We even talked about the idea that the self, each of our individual selves, is merely a personalized construct of the objective world around us. We've even toyed with the idea that there is no objective world, although our senses tell us that there's awfully good evidence to suggest otherwise. We've talked about structures and the mechanisms of narration. We've talked about how the mind works and the idea of metaphor. We are ready for anything now. Quote, "A great deal of postmodernist theory depends on the maintenance of a skeptical attitude, and here the philosopher Jean-François Lyotard is essential. He argued in his La Condition Postmoderne that we now live in an era in which legitimizing master narratives are in crisis and decline. The two main narratives Lyotard is attacking are those of the progressive emancipation of humanity, from Christian redemption to Marxist utopia, and that of the triumph of science. Lyotard considers that such doctrines have lost their credibility since the Second World War. Quote, simplifying to the extreme, I define postmodern as incredulity towards meta-narratives." That's from Butler. If you understand it, you can stop listening. The meta-narrative is the underlying grand narrative of a society. As individuals, we have unique personal narratives. A society also has a narrative. Meta, in this context, means underlying, and it doesn't necessarily have to be readily apparent. Lyotard is saying that the West is guided by the narratives of Christianity and later Marxism, and by the narrative of the progress of science. He says that these are teleological, dialectic concepts, and that our postmodernism is skepticism about those ideas. That's why irony plays a role in Pomo art. Pomo is skepticism about any overarching explanation for things, or any underlying rationale for things. In fact, one of the knocks against postmodernism is that while it is rife with skepticism, it isn't exactly bursting with solutions. And skepticism quickly becomes impotent cynicism. But critics of Pomo say that, not Lyotard. And doesn't skepticism about overarching explanations for things raise the question whether the overarching explanations of postmodernism ought not to be also accepted with skepticism? So if the meta-narrative is met with skepticism, where do we find truth? Well, that's a problem, because deconstruction intrinsically demands a starting position of relativism, where truth itself is always relative to the differing standpoints and predisposing intellectual frameworks of the judging subject. Or, truth is in the eyes of the beholder, because individuals can only know, as individuals, what that individual knows. Worse, we take that subjective view of things to be truth. We accept the cultural metaphors. We tend to privilege or rely upon, and again, these are quotes from Lyotard, we tend to privilege or rely upon what Derrida calls transcendental signifiers such as God, reality, the idea of man, to organize our discourse. and we see things in terms of their oppositions, such as male versus female. And as a result, get a lot of things wrong or too rigidly fixed. Nietzsche talks a lot about those dichotomies and the falseness of dichotomies. Worse, we place one of these dichotomies above the other. Oriental inferior to Western, for instance. We live not inside reality, but inside our representations of it. Linguistics shows us that we live and think via interlocking conceptual systems based on metaphors, individual narratives, cultural narratives, quote, which cannot be reduced in any way to a more literal language, and so are very unlikely to be simply or systematically compatible with one another. Language always fails to convey what it attempts to explain, according to Derrida. Language always fails to convey what it attempts to explain. No wonder he's the world's worst writer. One result of all this, and all of what I've been quoting is from Butler, is that history is pretty useless. You can't have objective history because all, quote, meaning is generated by socially encoded and constructive discursive practices that mediate reality so much that they effectively close off all direct access to it. Now, that's a quote from a man named Alan Munson. This is pretty important LD-wise, because it means that whenever we consult a historian, that historian is intrinsically unreliable. So when someone makes an argument that you can't trust X because he was a yada, 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 and didn't understand blacks or women or gays or whatever, that's what they're saying. Unfortunately, you similarly can't trust blacks and women and gays or whatever as historians, because they too are only able to see their own narratives. History is nothing but competing narratives. Great. Now what do we do? That is, as it turns out, key to critiquing criticism. If no one can be trusted, are we supposed to just give up? At its most ludicrous, as Butler points out, postmodernism even criticizes science as nothing but competing narratives. As I said, the problem with not believing in objective reality is that you must toss out all measures of objectivism. One would guess, therefore, that few physicists are postmodernists, or relativists, for that matter. They've got enough problems distinguishing between matter and energy, I guess. The most important postmodernist ethical argument concerns the relationship between discourse and power. A discourse here means a historically evolved set of interlocking and mutually supporting statements which are used to define and describe a subject matter. Crudely, it's the language of the main intellectual disciplines. For example, the discursive practices of law, medicine, aesthetic judgment, and so on. These discourses, as used by lawyers, doctors, and others, do not just implicitly accept some kind of dominating theory to guide them. They involve politically contentious activities, not because of the certainty with which they describe and define people, who is an immigrant or who is an asylum seeker or a criminal or mad or a terrorist, but because such discourses at the same time express the political authority of their users. Shades of Foucault. Knowledge and power unite to enforce a normalizing discourse on some disempowered group. Apply that to blacks, women, gays, whatever. And when your opponent argues Foucault, reply that since Foucault avoids any moral theories, and therefore no ethical measure of right and wrong, even if we were to accept Foucauldian analysis, we are given at the source no course of action. And that, my friend, is a very big knock against postmodernism. All cynicism, no action. The extraordinary achievement of Foucault and those who thought like him was, given their analysis of the workings of power, to go on to make one of the most influential of postmodernist claims. Most influential, the claim that such discourses entailed, imposed, demanded a particular kind of identity for those who were affected by them. In postmodernist jargon, they constitute the subject. That is, the meta-narrative imposes an individual narrative. The meta-narrative being the narrative of society, the individual narrative being you. A human being is not a unity, not autonomous, but a process, is perpetually in construction, perpetually contradictory, perpetually open to change. Individuals are caught in their cultural narratives. They are held captive by it. And if they are on the wrong side of the dichotomy, black instead of white, aboriginals instead of colonists, they are by default getting the short end of the narrative stick. But the problem remains. For us, as ethicists, even granting all of this, how do we find some way out of it? The postmodernists don't seem to offer a map. If your opponent is arguing this material, that may be the fatal flaw, where your analysis does provide potential change, while your opponent's only provides explanations of what needs to be changed. If identity is so based on culture, and so malleable, and so little in the hands of the individual, you can see why postmodernist art might be about the narrator. The narrator, in his or her complexity, becomes rather fascinating. Not merely a self, the individual is a process, a result of the social narrative. What does that mean if you happen to be an individual? Paul Auster, in City of Glass, assumes all of this and then wonders what that means in a novel. All of these ideas are complex, and many, when discussed by their creators, are contradictory. And they are certainly rife with jargon. Still, they are interesting. And that's why artists like them. But as we said, artists often get these ideas wrong or jumble them all up. That's why studying postmodern art can be frustrating. It's hard enough trying to understand the source material, but art is, in effect, a criticism of the source material, an attempt by someone else to understand and utilize that material. Maybe they get it right, maybe they get it wrong. So, of course, it's frustrating. If art is conceptual, it's not the object that matters, but the concept behind it. We've gone to the absolute extremity of understandability. I can look at a Rembrandt and figure out just about everything there is to figure out about it. Certainly the concept of Aristotle contemplating the bust of Homer is absolutely clear in every aspect. How do I understand the concept of art, on the other hand, where it's a sign on the gallery door saying that there is no exhibition, which was in fact an actual work of conceptual art? How do we explain that? How do we understand that? I'll give you a hint. It is, to a degree, a critique of the museum gallery complex, analogous to the military industrial complex. Oy. Art gets awfully complicated in this postmodern universe, and sometimes it gets perverse and outright silly, which may be why plenty of contemporary artists are, in fact, not postmodernist. It's a conscious choice an artist makes. They don't all choose it. And still, think about it. Even in the art world, the Foucauldian model of knowledge and power is clear. The power and knowledge are in the hands of those who mount exhibitions. They determined what is good art and what is bad art. Pity the poor artist who doesn't seem to get a vote. Anyhow, here's the bottom line. All of our postmodernists do a great job of providing a way to see our universe. It's neither a right way or a wrong way. It is a metaphor. Is language reality? Is there a reality? Do meta-narratives determine individual narratives? Who cares? The point is, these are often good ways of trying to understand what's going on around us. There are also other good ways. No offense, folks, but the suffragists had pretty clear ideas about human rights and the position of women in society long before there was such a thing as critical feminist theory. Use postmodernist ideas as aids in understanding things. They're a metaphor for the way things are. Marx was a metaphor for the way things are. So was Freud. So was Locke. So was Plato. So was a lot of people. I want to talk a little bit about language. And in my subhead, in the written version of this, this is called Some Stuff That Didn't Fit Into the Main Analysis. The concept of language carries a lot of weight in modern thought, and much of the good contemporary work in understanding how the mind functions is done in the scientific discipline of linguistics. Linguistics covers a lot of areas. What is language? How does language work? How do people use language? Obviously, language is a crucial construct of being human, and there is good reason to believe that humans are hardwired for language. That is, language is not simply something we've developed, like screwdrivers, useful but separate from the nature of our existence. Rather, language is thought to be inextricably linked to that very nature of our existence. It is thought to be not a learnt thing, but an instinct. It may not be that we speak because as culturally trained individuals we've learned how to speak, but because as animals we inherit an instinct to speak, the same way birds inherit an instinct to migrate south for the winter. They don't consciously think about it. They just do it. We don't consciously decide to communicate through language. We just do it. And there are many curious aspects to this. The language instinct is separate even from the ability to speak or hear. The rules that linguists have determined comprise a language are inherent even to deaf signing. Sign language, with no design or intention, conforms to all the rules of spoken language, even among those born deaf. That is, the way we learn to speak and hear, if we can do so, are almost identically emulated through signing and seeing by those who can't. And if you believe that language is a container for culture, as many people do, it is easy to understand why signers believe that their language is in fact the artifact of a unique culture, and not simply a mechanism to overcome an inability. There is much fascinating material to be got from linguists. Read on this, I strongly recommend Steven Pinker, the book The Language Instinct, and his other book How the Mind Works. Fantastic books explaining these concepts. Okay, language may be one of the most interesting things about us as human animals, and one of the most important. It is certainly reflective of our thought process, of the way we think. It can even be seen as the actual mechanism of the thought process. That is, language doesn't simply reflect our thoughts. Language actually is our thoughts, which could mean that language is not merely a part of being human, but is the determinant of being human. Language is not communication, but existence. I think, therefore I am. I am the sum of my thoughts. Now, whether or not you accept this as true physiologically, it is accepted as true metaphorically to many modern thinkers, which is why language and the study of language play prominent and seminal roles in postmodern thinking. Without going into great depth on this, here's the schematic. 1. A human being experiences sense perceptions. 2. That sensory information registers in the brain. 3. The brain processes that sensory information. 4. The end result for the human being is thought. The key thing to understand is that the thought is not the reality. The thought is the brain's computation based on reality, assuming the sensory perception is a measure of reality in the first place. The process of that computation is semiotic, performed in the medium of language. What the brain ends up with is a perception of reality rather than reality itself. Or in the words of postmodernism, the brain creates a metaphor for the reality. The metaphors add up to a narrative, and the individual's narrative is the sum of his metaphors. Simple enough. Well, simple enough if you've listened to the rest of the essay. What I'm doing here is throwing out some terminology, and we've touched on this already in semiotics. The underlying ideas are simple enough, but they carry heavy baggage of jargon. What you need to do is know what the buzzwords are to recognize them and the concepts they refer to. I'm also pointing out why language is so important in modern critical analysis. If language is the medium of thought, inextricable from thought, then the process of thought, a human instinct that defines humanity, then language must be pretty gall darn important and therefore words, which are the materials of language, must be pretty gall darn important too. And usage, which is the process of language, the manipulation of words, must be pretty gall darn important too. There are many ways to analyze words and their power. A racial epithet, for instance, has very straightforward power, derived from the simple history of the epithet, that can easily be analyzed outside of any sort of critical theory. If you stereotype someone, you are ignoring that person's individuality. So it's not as if critical theory has a monopoly on language study, but merely that critical theory is one way to approach language study. And do note that while I am seemingly beginning to use the phrase critical theory sort of interchangeably with postmodernism, I'm really not. They are not exactly interchangeable, at least not in all instances. Critical theory, underline that, critical theory, is a reasonable way to refer to the ideas of modern critical thought derived from postmodernist sources. Postmodernism is a reasonable way to refer to ideas that are contextually derived from or juxtaposed against modernism. If you're actually a postmodernism or a critical theory person yourself, you'll probably take exception to my loosey-goosiness on this, but then again, you're part of the problem and not part of the solution. So now let's take a critical theory look at the power of words. We start with euphemisms. A euphemism is the substitution of an agreeable or neutral term for an offensive term. The Victorians, those sexy devils, were loath to use the words leg or breast, hence the expressions light meat and dark meat. You most certainly can think of various innocent phrases used to describe bodily functions. We may train our children at a young age that they've got to go potty, for instance, or try this one. How'd you make out? I got to second base. And what exactly is second base anyway? That boy really knows how to make things happen out there. She was a soiled dove, a lady of the evening. You get the picture. Sexual terms are euphemized to allow us to discuss sex in polite society. Unpleasant terms are euphemized so that we can announce that we have to go to the bathroom without anyone being embarrassed by the rather natural idea of it. And I'll bet you can come up with 10 expressions for vomit in less time than it takes you to pray to the god of porcelain. Euphemism provides socially acceptable substitutes for socially unacceptable words and phrases. I'd rather be a sanitation engineer than a garbage man. Even at the simplest substitutional level, I'd rather be a custodian than a janitor. Once we get into euphemism, the next step is what has been called political correctness, a term loaded with negative connotations. We have Native Americans. We have African Americans. We talk not about slaves, but enslaved people. Why? What makes these better, more correct than other expressions? It's still the same people, after all. The point of these particular coinages is that they are not binary. We've talked about opposites and dichotomies and the assumption that one is good and the other isn't. Western Oriental, for instance. How about white and black? Same thing. Once you divide the world into two camps, the theory is that you pretty quickly decide that one camp is better than the other. If you're a black person, then you're not a white person. Black implies white. Black implies white through its opposition-apposition. But what's the opposite of African American? What's the opposite of Italian American or Native American? These phraseologies attempt to remove the binary opposition aspect from language. Yeah, they try to be correct for political reasons, but at a subconscious level, they do indeed come across as neutral insofar as they have no opposites, and certainly no preferable opposite, nothing that comes to mind immediately. They bestow a level of linguistic respect. And sure, it can go too far, but it's not necessarily a bad thing overall. Gay, straight, black, white, male, female, according to the theory, the language entails exclusion and ultimately demonization. If you think about it, this is merely a spin on the old referring to people as stereotypes argument, so it's not new, and trying not to do it is not terrible either. Words do have true power. And we've talked about that in the context of various resolutions over the years, hate speech being a perfect example. Words shape ideas, and ideas shape words. Look at historical fact. Start with the September 11th attacks. This led to the so-called Patriot Act. The Patriot Act contains various rights restrictions that would have previously been unthinkable. Now, because of its very name, if you don't agree with it, it's not that you're somehow defending human rights, you're unpatriotic. The president defined, quote, the war on terror. Subsequently, no matter what he does at the international level, it's the war on terror, including his attacks on Iraq. Don't agree with the president's policies? Then you must be in favor of terrorism. And who's the enemy? The, quote, axis of evil. We don't define or explain the enemy. We demonize them through language. Expressions like the axis of evil are metaphoric. There's further use of language like this called metonyms and synecdoche. This is sort of random stuff the linguists throw around, sort of fun to know. Metonym is an attribute of a thing. Synecdoche is a part of a thing. Here come the hired hands is a synecdoche. It refers to the workers by their relevant parts. Lend me your ears, listen to me, is a metonym. It refers to what ears do, which is hearing. The two concepts are very closely related, and they are words that are thrown around a lot in critical circles. So it's nice to know them when you hear them. And just because I don't know where else to put it, let's define essentialism. This is referring to someone on the basis of essential traits. You make a comment about women that references the fact that they bear children, for instance, essentialism. So let's look at debate. After all of this, finally, you must be wondering, what does this mean to debate? In our understanding of topics, you can combine some or all of the above. Semiotics, the underlying meanings of signs and signifiers, the power of language. Structuralism, looking at how all things of a certain sort work, rather than just one or two examples. Intrinsic meanings, rather than extrinsic results. Deconstruction, look for repression in exclusion, usually in exclusionary language. Foucault, the powerful, defined the normative. Metanarrative determines personal narrative. There is much writing about specific political and historical subjects done in something we've referred to along the way, critical theory. Sometimes this is just referred to as theory. In either case, CT is the application of the ideas of postmodernism to specific problems. A prime and seminal example of critical theory is critical legal studies. The background of critical legal studies commences with the Reagan administration. As more and more Republicans were tapped during this Republican era, most of the federal judges appointed were conservative, leaving many more liberal colleagues behind them, teaching in the law schools. Those liberal legal scholars believe that the system of law reflects the privileged subjectivity of those in power and that the system of law cannot be unbiased. These liberal academics, and I hate the association of liberal politics with critical theory, but the connection is, alas, real, formed critical legal studies. In other words, they were saying that the system of law is inherently flawed and biased. And you can clearly see the influences of structuralism, Foucault, and Derrida in this critical analysis. Critical legal studies people emphasized class and economic structure in their analyses. One major spin-off was critical race theory. Critical race theory insists that race is more critical to social structure than class or economics. Critical race theorists consider race upfront and personal. They use narrative to provide the stories that bring some understanding of the unstated assumptions of privilege. They want more than the theorists' contemplation of doctrines and principles. They want change, and they want it now. Unfortunately, I'm not sure how they expect to get it, the fundamental problem with any Foucauldian analysis. You can approach critical theory from a variety of angles. Another obvious big one is feminism. There's plenty of orthodox critical theory feminist doctrinists out there, and they're often used in debate. So here's what you ask yourself if you want to apply critical analysis. Where do you see the problem? In the individual? In the social structure? And where do you see the solution? In the individual or in the social structure? The critical theorist says the social structure. For example, look at teenage crime. If we believe that by providing security, basic needs, a family environment, and support for adolescents, they will not fall into delinquency, that's a structural approach. But if we believe that if we teach morals and strength of integrity to our young people, they will not fall into delinquency, that's an individual approach. We will find different policy approaches depending on the different theoretical perceptions of the social problem and the way it can be expressed as a function of tension between the individual and the social structure. The feminist approach to addressing social problems in critical theory is comparable. One often thinks of the radical feminist as one who views social problems structurally. The power structure excludes women, so we need to change the power structure. But to the extent that one believes that it is the individual woman who has false consciousness and must be made to see the falsity of her position, then both the problem and the solution to some extent are in the individual herself. That is, the social structure is out to get you, and worse, you've bought into it, a key feminist doctrine that seeks to explain why so many women aren't feminists. You can see here the meta-narrative dictating individual narratives. This whole critical theory discussion is based on a sort of Foucault model. The people in power create the normative, mixed with deconstruction, try to find the group that is excluded. There is no normal. There's only what the powerful claim to be normal. Feel free to apply it to religion, democracy, etc. Find some disempowered group, claim that they're excluded by the normative of the powerful, and you've got a debate case. The next step in this line of logic, by the way, is to assert that there is no reality, only what the powerful say is real. Which is, if you've ever been to the movies, The Matrix, which for some people is the absolute definition of relativistic, postmodern de-individualization. So, is there a summary for all of this? Of course not. We started as cavemen, with the creation of imperfect narratives to account for the fact that we had an imperfect understanding of reality. Today, as Frenchmen, we say that there is no reality and all narratives are, by definition, imperfect. Welcome to the 21st century. We still have no understanding of reality. Goodbye, and thanks for all the fish.